This is RNIB Connect Radio.
I'm Ravi Sagu, and a very warm welcome to Blind Notes on RNIB Connect Radio. In this six-part conversation series, I'll be speaking to different musicians each week, exploring their portfolio of work, their own musical loves, inspirations, and what drives them to perform the music they make. I myself have experience of impaired vision as I suffer from keratoconus, and I'm keen to explore how our guests have overcome their visual disabilities to make their own music and achieve their musical goals. Our guest today hails from a family background steeped in the rich tradition of Irish music and song. Some of her many highlights and successes include winning the second season of The Voice UK, releasing two studio albums, and she's performed to sellout audiences. She's an influential speaker and advocate in campaigning for visual impairment and disability issues. So join me for an hour of conversation with Irish singer-songwriter Andrea Begley. Andrea, lovely to have you with us today. I'm just really sad that we're having to do this remotely because I've got a plethora of friends over in Belfast, County Tyrone, Ballymena, Donegadee, but that's the way it is. We're doing it remotely, eh?
Yeah. Hello, Rami. I'm delighted to be here with you today as well. As you say, it's unfortunate it has to be virtual, but once things get back up and running, I'm sure you'll be back over to see us all here soon.
Let's hope so. Andrea, tell me about your visual disability and how it's affected you from childhood.
Well, my condition was caused originally, Robbie, by a condition known as juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. So many people wouldn't necessarily be familiar that rheumatoid arthritis in younger people can cause an eye condition known as uveitis, which is inflammation in your eyes. And from that, I then developed cataracts and glaucoma. So that was from a very young age, about 5. I initially had my cataracts removed. And then I developed glaucoma from that. So I've had, I think, maybe 23 operations over the years. So I've certainly got a few records on that front, but I've been treated very well in the health service. I've been to Glasgow, actually, and I've been to London and, of course, treated very well in Belfast by the surgeons here too. But sadly, my condition was very difficult to control, and as a result I have very, very limited vision now. Well, just a tiny amount of peripheral vision and some shadows and some very limited colours, so I would use a cane day to day to get around and things like that.
You've shown great spirit and resolve going through a number of procedures. I think you said it was about 23 there. Tell me, Andrea, where does this courage stem from? Because that's quite relentless.
Yeah, I suppose in one sense, I was lucky that a lot of the surgery I experienced was as a child and as a teenager, which seems ironic to say. But I think nearly at that age, you know, you just get on with things, and children are very adaptable, and teenagers as well. You know, it becomes just part of your life. And it was tough, especially traveling back and forth to hospital, never necessarily coming away with very good news. It was usually always, unfortunately, negative news. But I think the staff, my own consultant and everybody, really did try their best by me all the time. And I always knew people were looking out for me. And of course, I had great support from my own family. I've got two younger sisters, and my mum and dad would have been real rocks for me, I suppose, in those early days. But certainly, having spent a lot of my childhood in and out of hospital, it wasn't the world's most pleasant experience. But, you know, I knew it always was trying to do something to help me. So I suppose that was the one sort of solution to it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you also come from a very musical family. So what was your earliest memories of playing music and listening to music?
I suppose in terms of music influences, really, as you say, my music background is very much just been a part of my family background, really. It's in the fabric of the family, or the genes, as they say. A lot of people may or may not know that my aunt, Philomena Begley, is the queen of country music here in Ireland, as they call her. And she's, of course, been over to Scotland many, many times to perform and all over, really. And I guess that's really that family aspect, you know, singing and performing at family gatherings. And again, going even through my school days, going to the church, local church choir here, and being a part of the school choir, and all those various aspects, really, that's what shaped my early music interests, especially getting taken part in things like the Fesh and the Fla with the Irish traditional music side of things and the folk and the storytelling side of music. So, which again are very, very strong, especially in Scotland as well. So yeah, that's really where it all came from.
So yeah, culturally, you've always had that environment around you. How supportive were your family for your musical career as well, aside from your aunt? I mean, obviously, you know, you've mentioned schooling. How did all that kind of play in part with, you know, extracurricular learning for someone with a visual impairment?
Yeah, well, I was very lucky to have great music teachers in school, and I took lessons outside of school to play the piano. It was challenging as my vision got worse in terms of being able to read music. And, you know, people did try their best sort of get me in large copies of sheet music and things like that. I guess maybe in one sense, that's why I stuck most to the singing, because the singing was something that was a bit more accessible in a way. Some of the reading of music and sight reading and things for piano exams became quite challenging in the later years. And I never learned Braille, unfortunately, because I didn't go to school for the visually impaired. I was mainstream school. So a lot of my adaptations have really come through technology and in the early days when I could read larger print through that. But I mean, all my music teachers really, you know, they would have tried their best to make things accessible for me where they could. I think there's been a lot of headway made in the past even 10 years with how things have advanced during that now. But no, I always got great encouragement from family and from teachers. And as I say, that's probably why I did stick mostly to the singing, because it was just the sort of easiest route and the thing that I enjoyed doing the most as well.
We're going to hear a little something from the Begley family. Andrea, we will hear music from you, absolutely. But you've obviously got a rather famous aunt, Philomena. What's been your favourite record from her collection over the years?
Oh, there's so many. I suppose for us, especially in the family here, the songs that we would have grown up with Auntie Philly singing and going to the gigs and the dances and so on. You know, it's hard to pick one really, but I suppose the one that stands out for all of us would be her version of Blanket on the Ground. Brings back great happy family memories and as I say, growing up. And you know, it's just one of those songs everybody, as soon as it comes on, the floor will fill and we'll all get up and have a wee jive and have a bit of crack. And sure, that's what it's all about.
And let's hear that very track, Philomena Begley with Blanket on the Ground.
Come and look out through the window.
You're listening to Blind Notes with Ravi Sagu on RNIB Connect Radio. There's lots more content online at the RNIB Connect website. Simply head along to rnibconnect.org.uk. You can also contact us at radio@rnib.org.uk. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter. The handle is @RNIB Radio. I'm in conversation with Andrea Begley here on Blind Notes. I'm Ravi Sagu. Andrea, we just heard from your aunt there. I mean, that song itself, it must evoke so many memories, so many emotions.
Yeah, absolutely. And in recent years, Ravi, we've also performed and toured together, myself and my aunt and some of the other local country stars here. And that's been lovely. It's been really, really nice to, you know, do duets together and be on stage together. It's come full circle really, from being an audience member now to being on stage alongside her. And it's lovely to be able to share those kind of things really, and really does mean a lot.
Now, Andrea, I love deciphering an accent, especially when it's from the Emerald Isle. And I've actually got one of my friends, Finn, she's from County Tyrone, and I'm getting wee hints and glints of, you know, a County Tyrone accent, which is where you're originally from, but you've ended up moving to Belfast. Tell me about that journey.
Oh, yeah, well, I consider my accent to be a bit of a mix. There's definitely a lot of Tyrone in there, as you'd expect, being a Pomeroy native from the small village of Pomeroy. Funny, I moved to Belfast when I started university, and I'll tell you how many years ago that was. That'll be giving me age away. But yeah, back when I went down to Queens, I obviously moved down there, and that was really my first taste of being away from home as someone who was visually impaired, and I was quite daunted by it at the time. I'd never really, obviously I'd never been much further than just, you know, going to school or, you know, away staying with a friend or a relative for a few days or something. So yeah, it's been a journey since then, really. I've never fully moved home, but yeah, for the most part I would have lived reasonably independently with support. And, you know, that was important for me to be able to do. And I'm hoping to be able to get back to that in some shape or form when this is all gone again. But yeah, I love being in Belfast. It was great and having access to transport and things like that. Unfortunately, I live in quite a rural area in Tyrone, so sometimes that can be quite challenging when you're visually impaired, even though I love being back here and the sense of community and everything as well. There'll always be a big part of me belongs back here too.
And then obviously when you move to any city, you know, there's bigger opportunities, there's more going on. What were the attitudes you encountered as a blind musician playing at open mic nights, performing at live events? Were they receptive to someone with a visual disability? How did it work for you?
I have to say, all in all, everybody in the music scene's been very accepting. I generally found a lot of positive people, and you know, most people are there for one reason. They want to play their music, they want to listen to music. And that really, I think, makes it all a bit more equal and a bit more level. I was a bit more of a fish out of water being a girl as opposed to being visually impaired, because it did tend to be quite a lot of male singer-songwriters. But that being said, I was always very welcomed. You know, there's the obvious challenges, like, you know, small stages, lots of wires, trip hazards, so on and so forth. But I had good friends, a friend in particular, Mark, who taught me guitar. And we would have, you know, in the early days went and done the open mics and different gigs together. And he was great at being able to guide me, as were others. And I think once you sort of explain to people, like, I'm going to have a little bit of bother with this, would you be willing to show me how to get from here to here, or I need a bit of assistance with the steps and so on, most people are very understanding. But like gigging, you know, there will always be little trip hazards, and sometimes you can be playing in dark sort of environments and lots of stairs and things. So it's just something I think you have to be aware of. And travel obviously is another thing. So it's handy when the gigs are nearby, or you can catch a lift with somebody as well.
Well, as you know, venues and gig venues and concerts, halls, etc., you know, over the last so many years, they've just got so much better with health and safety. You know, as someone that's went to a plethora of gigs, you know, I remember back in the day, I used to call it health and miss safety because there was wires everywhere and whatnot. But things have definitely got better, touch wood.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. You've touched upon it there, that your friend Mark, how important is it to have your own sort of personal network to steer the actual logistics of performing at different venues? How important is that, you know, for you with the visual impairment and getting out there and gigging?
Oh, I would say it's absolutely vital. You know, you do need that bit of extra support sometimes. I've been very reliant on music friends, you know, as I say, even getting to venues sometimes if they're in a rural place, you know, not being able to drive. If you were reliant on public transport, it could take you 2.5 days to be on time for a gig. And so you do become very reliant on contacts and colleagues. And especially in my case, my parents and my sister would still be very, very much helping me out on that front. So it is important to have that network, because, you know, we all need support networks, but especially as visually impaired musicians, you do need that little bit of extra help. And, you know, if you go to a venue to set up, and as you say, things have definitely got a lot better with health and safety, but that doesn't mean that there's not still difficulties and challenges. So yeah, having support is vital.
Now, you obviously share the same surname as your aunt, Begley, and that name in itself is steeped in music tradition. And I'm always keen, especially when there's musicians in the family, to ask, how would you define your style and your songwriting style, Andrea?
Well, I suppose I've listened to such a different variety of music, and I know most musicians probably say that, so that's a tad of a cliche, but genuinely I have. My interests in music are very changeable. I could listen to anything from Mary Black and Cara Dillon to Irish country music, like my aunt Philomena, or Katie Tunstall, who's I really have a lot of admiration for, Paolo Nutini, Bruno Mars, big fan of his, Billy Joel, like such a variety of people. And I suppose song-wise and writing-wise, my style of singing would probably fit more in that kind of Eva Cassidy, Norah Jones style, another really great singer, Melody Gardeau, a little more on that fringe really. But you know, a whole plethora really and of influences, and of course the script as well from here and voice days, and yeah, just a huge variety. I have a lot of admiration for them all.
Well, Andrea, we're going to spin back to your debut album of 2013 with the title track. Would you like to lead us into this song?
Yeah, thanks. I'm very, very proud of this song. I wrote it originally when I went on a short songwriting course in Belfast Crescent Arts Centre. Gosh, that's a few years ago now. But when I got the opportunity to work with Danny O'Donoghue from the script, we slightly changed it around a bit and changed the chorus and stuff. So the finished product is something I really am so pleased with how it came out in the end, and the addition of the cello and the violin and everything to it really helped to bring it to that next level. So I hope people like listening to it. And this is called The Message.
Agonized over the words to you.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The helpline's open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
You're listening to Blind Notes on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm Ravi Sagu in conversation with Irish singer-songwriter Andrea Begley. Andrea, obviously radio airplay for any musician is important, but television has played like a massive, massive role in giving you exposure. And that song that we just heard, The Message, was quite significant in this part of your music journey. Tell me more about this chapter, a certain Steve Lillywhite.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So originally when I wrote the song, The Message, one of the shows that I was involved in was a show known as The Hit, and it was a songwriting programme made for RTE Television in South of Ireland. And they were seeking 10 songs, original songs, to be submitted so the two Irish artists may record them. And it was kind of like a bit of a TV competition, if you like, but based around songwriting. So my mum saw the note in the paper about it, and I thought, okay, I'll maybe try and put my song in for this, not really having any expectations. And lo and behold, one of the people who judged the songs for submission was none other than Steve Lillywhite, and he was very complimentary about my song. That was kind of the start of the TV really exposure, and it was a great experience. Went down to Dublin to do the recording. Actually, I have a funny story about that. I'd been on holiday and got waylaid in London due to missing my flight home, and I just made the TV recording in Dublin literally by the skin of my teeth. So it was let's just say that didn't help with the nerves on the day. It's a funny part of it. I ended up getting a Ryanair flight from London to Dublin. And as you know, sometimes airport assistance can be a little bit slow at getting you off the plane. So Ryanair, in their efficiency, really turned their flights around so quickly. So no sooner had we landed from London to Dublin than the lady, our hostesses at the front, explaining to people coming on board that we were all heading to Malaga. And I thought, oh no, I'm not supposed to be heading to Malaga. I'm supposed to be recording a TV thing now, so I need to get off this plane pretty quickly. So yeah, that was, let's just say, that was an interesting addition to the whole TV recording that day.
Oh, what you wouldn't give for a flight to Malaga now, eh?
Well, exactly. You wouldn't be fighting with anybody over it now, that's
absolutely
for sure.
Absolutely. And, you know, a massive compliment because, Steve Lillywhite, he knows a thing or two about making records, yeah, doesn't he? So obviously television's continued to play a part of your career. What led to you entering the second season of The Voice UK?
Well, again, this was a bit of a coincidence. I never really planned to do anything like The Voice or X Factor or anything like that. It really wasn't in my mind at all. Some people, you know, sort of look and say, oh, I'll definitely go on and give that a go sometime. But it kind of happened by accident, really. A friend of mine who ran one of the open mics in Belfast at the time had been contacted by the scouts for the show, who generally go around, or had at least then went around different parts of the UK scouting for talent that might be interested in auditioning. And he put forward my name as a regular that came down, and he said, you should, you know, think about at least meeting them and see where it goes. So I give it a bit of thought and thought, wasn't really sure if it was for me. And then I thought, okay, I will. And I did go down, and they were initially very receptive. And I thought, oh, well, maybe they're just being polite. And further to that, I got a proper audition with the producers. And they sent me an email. I completely misread the time on it. I thought it said 8:30 in the evening, but they meant 8:30 in the morning. So I turned up again. There's a bit of a pattern emerging here, isn't there? I turned up like unceremoniously 12 and a half hours late or something. And they were all leaving to go and have their dinner at the end of a very long day of auditions. And I thought, okay, well, that's my own fault. I didn't read the thing properly and just leave it. You know, it's just not meant to be. So they were very insistent that they'd have a listen to me when I came in. And to be honest, I thought they were just, again, being polite. But yeah, so from there, never expected anything further to happen. But they let me know they wanted me to formally audition then for the programme in Manchester in front of the four coaches. So that was where it really all started from there.
Fantastic. Timing seems to be a bit of a theme here, eh?
It does, yeah. You'd think that I might need to go back to school and be taught how to read the clock, couldn't you?
So, listen, I'm just thankful that I was on time and you were on time today as well. We didn't clash. So tell me more about being on the show, which you eventually went on to win. How much of a catalyst was this, being crowned the winner, you know, a launching pad for your professional recording career? Take me back to that time in your life.
Well, it most definitely was an amazing experience. I think maybe because I didn't have any pre-existing thoughts about what was going to happen. It was all very much, I kind of just took it in my stride at the time because I didn't expect that it would be such a big thing or go so far. And at the end of it, to even get to the final at that stage, I thought, wow, this is massive overachievement here, because I didn't really even think I'd get through the first part of it. So to win then was just unbelievable. I'm still, I think, shocked to this day, but I suppose that's a credit definitely to the great support that I had at home here. And I know I had a lot of support in Scotland too. And, you know, people really did genuinely get behind me. And that's just so vital. Like, you can put all the music in the world together and it can be absolutely lovely music and nothing wrong with it. But if an audience doesn't want to listen to it or doesn't buy into you as an artist, then that's where you're in trouble. So the show was a fantastic catalyst for me. It gave me great opportunities, got to perform in the Albert Hall and travel to China to perform. But at the end of the day, it's the audience, the grassroots audience here at home who have been my great support. And I've also got great audiences across the world. That's the beautiful thing, I suppose, about digital distribution these days of music. If there's one benefit to it, it means your music's reaching to the four corners of the world. You know, I can go on and see where people are listening to my music now on Spotify, like of all places, from Indonesia to the Congo to absolutely everywhere, which is just, the world is such a small place now for music.
How significant was the show's format, where the judges are unable to see the contestants' auditions, in your factor in applying for the show? Because in life, we often get judged on appearances, you know, the way we look, you know, especially folk like us who suffer from visual impairments. We can have that in the, you know, the back of our heads. But this format was completely different, where the judges couldn't see you.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I don't know if that necessarily played a massively conscious part of my decision to give it a go. I suppose it was there in the background. I think maybe also I felt that the programme was a bit more genuinely music focused, and maybe that is partly down to the fact that the coaches don't see you initially. Some of the other shows are a lot more focused on the visual aspects of it, how you look, what you wear, if you move around the stage. And, you know, a lot of those things, it's not to say they're impossible for visually impaired artists, but they are more difficult. So, yeah, I guess unconsciously it was probably in my mind that it was a bit more of an equal playing field. For once, people actually just had to listen as opposed to just listening and looking at the same time.
We're going to head to a music track now, again from the Emerald Isle. And one of the members of this particular band was part of your journey on the show, and we'll get behind that once we come back from the song. I'm sure this is significant for a number of folk, especially Andrea. This is The Script and The Man Who Can't Be Moved.
Going back to the corner where I first saw you. Gonna camp in my sleeping bag, I'm not gonna move. Got some words where I first saw you. Gonna camp in my sleeping bag, I'm not gonna move.
You're listening to Blind Notes on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm Ravi Sagu, in conversation with Irish singer-songwriter Andrea Begley. We just heard The Script with The Man Who Can't Be Moved. Quite significant, The Script in your life as well, Andrea. Danny O'Donoghue's mentored you on the show. What was it like working with Danny?
Oh, it was great. It really was great. And nice to be able to work with a fellow Irish person as well, I suppose. Yeah, no, as I say, when I went and did the audition, I didn't expect anybody to turn around for me. And I was lucky enough to have both Tom and Danny turn for me. It's not easy picking between Tom Jones and Danny O'Donoghue. It definitely was a difficult choice, two legends in their own right. I suppose in the end up, I went with Danny because of, well, firstly, I was a script fan, and also I liked, you know, his songwriting style in particular. So we had a great time working together on the show and learned a lot, really. You know, Danny was very good at letting you have your own sort of say, and he understood the importance of, you know, writing the songs and things like that. Obviously, the show was all a lot to do with covers, and I still do a lot of covers, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it was nice to be able to blend the two. And after the programme, he was keen to work with me on my song, The Message. And we've been in touch again recently there, because he was actually back on the show a few months ago. So we were messaging back and forth about reminiscing about the time that we were working together on the show as well.
So when you were on the show, how did you find out that the judges had turned around, or, you know, was there any kind of cues to you?
No, actually nothing. I was really sort of puzzled by that, because on the show, when you're watching it back on TV, there's usually kind of a loud noise when they turn around. But it wasn't until I went to the show and I was talking to people afterwards, I was like, well, I'd had to end up asking, did anyone turn around? Because I genuinely didn't know. And I thought that if anyone did, then I'd have heard it. But when I asked them afterwards, the people involved behind the scenes, I was like, why could I not hear it? Or was I just so far gone that I didn't notice? And they said, no, it's like superimposed afterwards. So you wouldn't actually have been able to hear it in the studio. So hence the reason why I was asking, did anyone actually turn?
What I'm always interested to find out is that, you know, you follow these TV shows, but, you know, what's life like after winning the show? What actually happens to the winner? What do you win? Is there any funny stories that you can, you know, share from this time? What actually happens once, you know, because as a viewer, you just see you winning on telly. Mm-hmm. And then if you're lucky, you'll get like a follow-up show, a documentary a year later. But what happens? Tell me.
Well, that's it. I mean, I initially, when Holly called out my name, I suppose for the first, well, I was going to say for the first few minutes, I would say for the first day, I was in a bit of a daze. I was behind the scenes of the show towards the end thinking, oh goodness, this is going to be such a nightmare, having to pack up my suitcase. This is like what was in my head, thinking we're going to be heading back to Northern Ireland tomorrow. And I have everything around the room in the apartment we were staying in, just thinking, oh, it's going to take me all night. Because obviously we all knew we were going to some kind of a bit of a party afterwards. It's like, it's going to take me ages to get gathered up for this flight first thing tomorrow. And never at all expected to be called out as the winner. And when it did happen, you know, you're initially very much caught up in a whirlwind of, you know, people congratulating you, obviously talking to family members, going to the after party, doing a lot of press interviews. Like the whole next day I spent just talking to different press outlets and papers and radio and things like that. So, you know, it takes you a while to kind of come down from that and all the hype and so on. And then when that sort of initial phase is over, really, it's then getting into the nuts and bolts of what are you going to do now with your music. So as part of The Voice, you won a contract to work with Universal Music. So that enabled me to have a record deal and a book deal, which was all part of the show. So I started work really right away on my first album, obviously working with Danny again to do The Message, and then gigs and things in between, getting a bit of a tour organised. And it was just go, 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 really, for that initial phase. And then things just sort of naturally quieting down a bit, because obviously there's a new series of the show and the focus is on a new person. And really, from that stage, you know, you're kind of back to really directing your career yourself. It's up to you now. You've been given the platform, and it's what you do with it and how you choose to kind of put yourself out there and what your new music is and connect with your audience and take it from there, really.
Talking about audiences, you've played to audiences in Beijing. How did you get over there?
Yeah, that was a really wonderful part of the early journey after the show. So as I'm sure listeners would be aware, The Voice is not just something in the UK. It's really international. It's everywhere, really. And it's absolutely massive in the likes of Vietnam and China, America, everywhere, really. So what they had in Beijing was a Voice of the World competition. And it was performance held in one of the Olympic arenas there. and a number of us from the different voice programs over the world. So one guy who's actually English, a guy called Nick, but he won the Voice of Germany. And another girl, Dia Frampton from America, The Voice in America, she was there. And a number of artists from The Voice Vietnam and China performed all songs that we were best known for in the show in this arena concert. And it was just amazing. There was obviously thousands of people there, and it was my first time to be in Beijing. And it was great hustle and bustle, and just a totally different experience and culture, and really, really enjoyed it. And the Chinese audience were so receptive and lovely. And yeah, it was just great.
As the old adage goes, music certainly travels.
Yeah.
We're going to take a wee break now, and we're going to play you a track from the album Soul of a Songbird. Now, Andrea, is there a favourite song from this particular album?
Well, this is my second studio album, and you know, there's a fairly big diversity of songs on the album, some covers and some originals, but one of my favourites is an original song called I Do, which I wrote in honour of a number of my cousins who actually got married in the same year, and I just found I was singing at their weddings and friends as well, and I thought, you know what, it would be nice to be able to write a song that kind of gets that sentiment across. So hence the reason for this song, I Do.
I give you my heart, take care of it for me, I love you, I do.
Andrea, you're an ambassador for RNIB Northern Ireland. You're a passionate campaigner for issues around visual impairment and disability. What are some of the biggest challenges that these communities still face in education, employment and services today?
Well, I've been involved with RNIB really, I suppose, since my university days. So when I was 19, I became aware of RNIB's volunteering service through a mutual friend in university. And while I'd heard about RNIB before that, I suppose I was a bit ignorant about what they actually did in terms of campaigns and stuff. And also, I guess it took me to the latter years of my teens to be confident enough to say, yeah, I am visually impaired and, you know, so what? I guess there was that period in my life where, like, a natural acceptance, really, where you had to learn to say, oh, actually, I can't do something because of my sight, but I just need a little bit of extra help to do it or a bit of support. And once I got over that kind of period in my life where I wasn't sure what or how to deal with my vision impairment, I was very much aware that a lot of the nervousness and indeed some of the barriers I'd faced around it were actually something that I could lend my voice to try and change. So when I got involved with RNIB initially, it was on their campaigns team and helping to lobby politicians around access issues, whether that be transport, access to information, employment, education. You know, I've been very, very lucky that I've had great support from my family and others and my teachers. And that's enabled me to get to third level education and to work as well and to do my music. But there are a lot of hurdles still out there for visually impaired people. And I'm very much determined that some of the challenges and the hurdles I faced and continue to face, that others don't have to, because it's important that we kind of pave the way to make life a bit easier for those that are coming behind us. We do live in a world now where there, ironically, it's never been as easy to make things accessible because of technological advances, but yet we still see a lot of things where visually impaired people are forgotten about or left out of. A lot of the time, not because we're intentionally being sidelined or ignored. It's more because people just don't think, and it's an ignorance of just not knowing or not understanding. And anything we can do to collectively highlight that and say, look, if you think about us from the beginning, it won't be that hard to change your product or your service, because all we need sometimes is things just changed a little bit to make them something that we can do as well.
Yeah, I think you've really hit the key there, you know, motivating and inspiring people from your own firsthand experiences. You talk about it when you're, you know, campaigning and you're out on the road. And hopefully things are getting better and there's more awareness. Ultimately, do you think representation has got better for visual impairment in film, television, the media as a whole, you know, society? Do you think it has challenged in getting out there more?
Oh, I definitely think it has. You know, if I look at things like even social media, like TikTok or, you know, Instagram or whatever, there's a lot more presence now of visually impaired people online saying, look, I'm visually impaired. This means I use a dog or a cane, or sometimes I've got a visual impairment and I don't have an obvious sign of my visual impairment. So just be aware not everybody fits the standard prototype that people might have in their mind. There is definitely greater representation in film and TV now compared to what there was. Is it enough? And sometimes is it done well? That's a different question, I think. I do think we have some way to go to have good levels of representation and equal levels of representation. And unfortunately, quite often you do tend to find a lot of roles continue to be played by non-visually impaired actors, or even in the music industry, you know, there's not a huge representation of people who are visually impaired. I mean, there's the obvious massive names like Stevie Wonder and Ray Charles and Andrea Bocelli and so on, but there's a long way to go, I think. And there are definitely barriers there that we do face, but I suppose my chief concern at the minute would be, you know, it's making sure that we have the ability to participate in all those different industries. And I wouldn't like to think that we'll be, you know, things will be going backwards now post all that's been happening with the coronavirus. You know, we all want to see things continue to progress, and they were heading in the right direction. So hopefully that's a good sign.
How important has music been in your life?
Oh, music's been fundamental, and it continues to be, and it always will be. You know, no matter whether it's singing in the house to myself or learning a song or writing a song, and, you know, even if nobody ever hears it, there's something just wonderful around the escapism of music and the freedom that it offers you, just the joy that you take out of it, even on an individual level. And then that's tenfold when you get the opportunity to perform in front of other people and get some of the lovely compliments and the kind words that I get back from audiences as well. But there's nothing else like it, really. You know, it's so special to the human soul, and it's just not replaceable with anything.
Andrea, when you look over your career to date, how do you think your visual impairment has affected your relationship with music?
I suppose in ways, I feel for me, music is something that I can really fully participate in. You know, I can lift the guitar and play it, not terribly well, mind you, or the piano, but you can escape with it. You know, it's a total leveler and a total equalizer. You can go into a room and perform to people or listen to other people perform. And, you know, yes, of course, there's always the visual element to people's performances, but, you know, everybody, no matter whether they're sighted or not, can shut their eyes and be carried away by listening to other people singing or performing instrumental music. And it's hard to replace that kind of connection. And I think being visually impaired in particular, it maybe makes that connection a little bit stronger, because you do, you know, it is a lot about feel and sound. And clearly, while our hearing and that isn't necessarily better than other people who don't have sight loss, I suppose is that bit more acute, and we're tuned into things more, and maybe sound kind of affects and we listen to it maybe more deeply, because that's our key way of connecting to things. So maybe that's a small part of it as well.
Andrea, it's been lovely having you with us today. It's honestly been a really fascinating journey into your life and music today. Thank you. Perhaps you can lead us into your new single, Dancing in the Sky, which is out now.
Thank you, Robbie. It's been an absolute pleasure to join you as well. I've really enjoyed chatting to you. And I'm going to just say a few words then now about my new single, Dancing in the Sky. So the reason why I recorded this song really is, for a lot of people, this has been a very heavy year, a lot of loss, not just in relation to coronavirus, but in relation to so many other things, and people being restricted in terms of seeing their families. And this song, while it's quite emotional and quite sentimental, it's also very much looking to hope, to life beyond this world, and clinging to that idea of dancing in the sky and to the maybe happier thoughts and memories of those that we maybe have lost along the way. And yeah, I hope people enjoy it.
Andrea, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Blind Notes with me, Ravi Sagu, which is a Demos production supported by the Audio Content Fund for RNIB Connect Radio.
Tell me, what does it look like in heaven?
Is it peaceful? Is it free like they say?